Welcome to Crosswalk America's podcast. This is Eric Elnis, and this is my first ever live interview, so to speak. It won't be live by the time it gets to you, but it's live right now in the Papago Brewing Company in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm sitting here with Tom Ott, who is UCC, United Church of Christ minister, from Webster, New York, which is a suburb of Rochester, I believe. And he's been on sabbatical for a bit, and we've been getting to know him this week as he's been studying our church in Scottsdale, Scottsdale Congregational United Church of Christ. And he's been on sabbatical for a while and has learned some interesting things, and I thought, you know, maybe he would be interested in, or at least consents to being interviewed in some of the high points of what he's learned on his journey. And I first want to ask you, Tom, what is it you were setting out to discover or learn about on your sabbatical? How long was it? And well, we'll go from there.
Okay, thanks. Well, the theme of my sabbatical was really from the wonderful text in Ephesians from chapter 4, where it talks about the role of equipping the saints for the work of ministry. And I read that text and realized how little I knew about what it really took to equip the saints for the work of ministry. And so I wanted to think more deeply about that. I realized I'd spent a good part of my first 25 years in the pastorate being a minister for people, which I think is something profoundly different than equipping people for ministry. A big part of my pastorate was spent praying for people, studying scripture for people, delivering the Cliff Note version on Sunday morning. I got a lot of positive strokes for doing that, but at the end of the day, when I asked, am I really helping to equip the saints for the work of ministry, it didn't really feel like I had. So the sabbatical is to help me think more deeply about what it really takes to equip the saints for ministry. And I started off with a trip that followed the footsteps of Paul, who probably more than any person other than Jesus knew what it meant to equip people for ministry.
I'm going to stop you right here first. I want to know, when you say equip the saints for ministry or equip people for ministry, what does that mean in real terms for you? When you say equip and these people, what are you thinking about when you're thinking about equipping people?
Well, I think the ministry that people do, for the most part, happens when they leave church. It happens in the places where they live out their faith, in the places where they live and work and play. It's invisible to most of us. It's invisible to me as a pastor. I see people in church. I don't have much contact with people in their daily lives. But I think at a deep level, people are asking the question, what does it mean for me to live faithfully in the world? And the answers that they're getting from the church aren't very helpful. In a lot of churches, they're getting a message that has no correlation to Monday morning. They get a message on Sunday that takes them to an ancient world and doesn't really connect with what it means to live in the 21st century. Or they go to a church where they get very simplistic answers to very complicated dilemmas that they live with every day, and I don't think either of those are helpful.
So, and you're saying Paul, you feel, had a special take on that, so you went back to Greece and Turkey to explore that. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, and it's interesting. In a lot of ways, I think we're in a similar place to where Paul was. Paul is, when he visits Athens, he's in this community where there are gods to every, there are shrines to every imaginable god in this city. And at one level, he's deeply troubled by it. At another level, he's in awe of how deeply religious these people are. And he spends a lot of time in the culture, just getting a feel for what matters most to these folk. And, you know, instead of coming in and giving a fire and brimstone sermon, he really engages the culture. And I mean, he has this wonderful speech where he, you know, he says, I see how deeply religious you are in every way, and I've been walking through your city, and I've noticed this shrine to an unknown god. I know something about that one. Let me tell you what I know. And he engages the people of Athens in this wonderful dialogue, and he's not speaking over and against the culture, but neither is he speaking as part of the culture. He has a foot in both worlds, and is able to help people think about what it means to live a life that has God as in its center. And he does that in a way that doesn't depend on him. He never stays anywhere very long. He stays long enough to create community, then moves on. And it's never a perfect community. I mean, he's always sending these letters back, trying to sort of correct things when they get off track, and is always lamenting about how we might have done things differently. And it's never perfect, but he has this deep trust in the gospel and in the people to whom the gospel's been entrusted. So,
what did you find when you were over there? Did anything get added to your conceptions of Paul or changed when you were in Greece and Turkey where he had actually walked?
Yeah, a couple things. He walked a lot. I mean, we were in a bus, and I was exhausted at the end of each day of our bus tour. So to think about covering that ground by foot and by boat was inconceivable to me. I mean, it spoke to his deep commitment, his deep passion for reaching people. I was struck by how willing he was to let go of things. I mean, here's a person who's raised in this tradition that has fed him and has been a wonderful gift to him. And yet, as he engages the culture, he realizes that that all of these rules and laws and customs and traditions are going to be a barrier, and he's willing to let go of them. I mean, at a deep level, he knows what's core and what's not, and he's willing to let go of the stuff that isn't core, and is willing to say, you know, this is important to me, this is important to my tradition, but we don't have to take this with us.
You know, that's fascinating, actually. I think about Paul, and I think about how much he hung on to, and how he was beaten and left for dead, you know, at the outskirts of all these cities and so forth. You know, he had to really hang on to a whole lot. You know, you're saying, as you went through, how much he was also willing to let go of, and you're absolutely right. I mean, he was able to let go of so much that really was part of the cultural kind of milieu, the historical social context, in order to hang on, you know, to what really mattered, and let that, whatever really mattered, kind of morph into those different settings.
Yeah, not many of the stories end happily. I mean, he doesn't have, there's only a few of them where he gets these warm, fuzzy letters back, and most of them, yeah, he's run out of town or sneaks out of town. But yeah, because he travels lightly, he's able to embrace the things that are really at the core of his identity and of his faith. And you know, at some level, I think that's where we are. I mean, we're not accustomed to traveling lightly. We accumulate all this stuff in our culture, but it leaves us feeling empty. I mean, we try to satisfy it by getting more stuff, but it never fills us. And so, I think there's a part of us that realizes we have to let go. And by letting go, we learn what's really at our core. So that's one of the things that Paul taught me.
So does that lead you at this point, I know you're not really back all that long yet, but does that lead you to think about, well, what could I let go at my church or in my own life? Or what are you looking at letting go of as a result of that?
Yeah, at a personal level, it's really helped me realize how deeply important it is for me to keep Sabbath, to protect time for prayer and meditation. You know, the busier I get, the more important those things become. And I find that the more attention I give to those things, the more centered I am as I go through the craziness of my day. And I think that's true for all of us. I think, you know, we have this idea that we can squeeze prayer into the margins when we have time, and I think that's a mistake that we make, that prayer really has to be the thing that we give the highest priority. And when we do that, it helps put everything else in its right context. So at a personal level, it's made me recognize how important my own prayer life is. At the church's level, it's made me realize that we probably spend too much time doing things at church. The real effectiveness of the church shows up on Monday, not Sunday. And in some ways, the busier we are at church, the more we minimalize the significance of what happens when people leave church. What I'm really drawn to is finding ways to bring Monday into Sunday. Now, you've talked about that in some of your writing, and I was really struck by that. I think in church we tend to create this whole culture, this church culture that has almost no connection with the lives that people live when they leave the church. One of my priorities in going back is to spend a lot more time visiting people in the places where they work rather than when they come to church for meetings and small group gatherings and worship. Not that worship isn't important and small groups aren't important, but they're important because they illuminate what happens on Monday. And
good point. Now you're back from Greece and Turkey, and you've been, what else have you been doing on your sabbatical?
Well, I've been going around visiting churches that are that have thriving worship life, especially churches that are reaching folks, sort of the post-boomer crowd, the 45 and under crowd, who by and large aren't drawn to churches like the one I serve, mainline Protestant churches. They find it boring, they find it irrelevant. So I've been trying to find churches that are reaching those folk, and I've been paying attention to churches that are doing an effective job in creating community. I find this deep hunger for community, authentic community, not the superficial kind of conversation that happens around the coffee urn, but the kind of community that allows people to know intimately what's happening in each other's lives, to care for one another deeply, and to support each other in their efforts to live faithfully in the world. So churches that have effective small group ministries that help people connect their faith and daily life are the things that I've been searching for.
And what did you find then? Give us the highs and the lows from your search since you've been back.
Yeah, it's been sobering. I wrote to all the national staff in our denomination and every conference minister to ask them to point me to churches they knew of that were doing effective worship and had a thriving small group ministry. I didn't hear back from about half of the people that I contacted. They were either on vacation or just didn't get my email. The ones that I did hear back from, about half of them said, I don't know anybody like that. And the ones that wrote back and recommended some places, very few of them fit the criteria that I was looking for. They tended to be large, urban, multicultural churches that are very different than the kind of church that I serve. And I didn't feel confident that the learnings that they had come upon would translate very well into my context in suburban Rochester, New York. So that was a little discouraging. I visited about four churches in the Rochester area that had thriving churches, regardless of what denomination their affiliation was. Most of them were unaffiliated. They were community churches. And just tried to insert myself in the community and get a feel for what was going on. There were some exciting things happening. There were some exciting things happening in worship. One of the churches I went to, the most effective church that I went to locally, did an amazing job engaging all the senses in worship. They had a worship service where the pastor had just come back from vacation, and he had read a book on vacation about the moral qualities of David that made him an effective leader, and he thought that was a great book, and he recommended it. He had copies available for people to read on their own if they just wanted to grab a book to read on the way into during their lunch hour at work or whenever. It was a great thing. He said, you know, I'm going to do a 4-part series on David's qualities of leadership that are evidenced in the stories of David. So this would be a great book for you to read. It'll enhance your worship experience. They'd also created some small group opportunities for people to have conversation about that resource, which I thought was kind of neat. I was there in worship at the beginning of the series, and they had an artist who came up onto the worship platform and just started painting at the beginning of the service. Didn't say anything, no reference was made to him. There was just a big 4 by 6 foot canvas up on the stage with big blocks of color, and he just started working on this painting, and you didn't know what it was until the pastor got into his message, and his message was on David's qualities that made him an effective leader. And about the time the sermon got to its peak, the painting materialized in a way that you could see it was David wrestling with a lion, and the courage and the perseverance of David in the midst of adversity sort of became visible in the painting, and you heard it in the pastor's message. So it was this wonderful worship experience where you could watch the painting, you could listen to the sermon, you could listen to the band playing, you could gather what you needed in worship to help you think about what it meant for you to be faithful in the dilemmas that you face in work. So that was the most engaging worship that I found.
Well, it sounds like it was also, worship was set in the context of the daily life, was saying, there's a book here you can read, there's a small group you can get involved in as well, so that there's really a continuing experience of worship even beyond that Sunday morning.
Yeah, I didn't assume that everyone was in the same place, which was one of the exciting things to me. This is a church that really thought about resourcing people at a variety of different levels. If all you had time for was an hour on Sunday morning, then you could come there, and it would be a good experience. And it was the best worship that I experienced locally. But if you wanted to go a little deeper on your own, you could pick up the book in the narthex and read it on your own. But if you wanted to think deeper about it in conversation with other people of faith, you could gather with a community and engage the book and the text and your own life experience in a deeper context. So they had created a space for everyone, and I thought that was intriguing, because in a lot of our churches we assume everyone's at the same place, and we have sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to spirituality, and I don't think that's very helpful.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, what do you say the top one or two other highlights from the rest of your journey then, as you went across the country looking at these vital communities? What else would you point to if you just highlight one or two more?
Well, I went out to St. Paul, Minneapolis to spend some time at Luther Seminary. They have a special project called the Centered Life Project. And their whole focus is on working with local congregations so that they can provide a helpful resource for helping people connect their faith in daily life. And I visited the director, a guy named Jack Fortin, who's on faculty at Luther Seminary, and I visited 4 churches in the St. Paul area that are relating to the Centered Life Project to hear what they're doing. And it's interesting. One of the key pieces they've come across is the importance of recovering vocation and the sense that that we are called by God to use the gifts that God has entrusted to us to make a difference in the world. And so one of the big pieces that these churches are wrestling with is how do we help people discern what our gifts are and where we're called to use them? So I was intrigued by that. They have an interesting discernment process that I think I'll send some of our folk to get trained in. It's called Dependable Gifts, and it helps people think about what gives them the most energy, what are they good at doing, what are the places where they find their energy is drawn in life, what are the contexts in which they use their gifts, and it really sort of trusts the community to help the individual discern where they're being called to be in ministry.
That's great. It's boggled me for a long time, actually, that churches spend so much time on mission projects, and my church included. We spend a lot of time on mission. You know, we are involved in homeless ministries, and just this morning we were, you know, collecting, you know, clothing for the homeless and so forth. But you know, somebody gets involved in a mission project, and they're maybe involved 1 or 2 hours a month or a week, even if that's, they're really intensive. But yet, when it turns to vocation, I mean, we're actually asking somebody to commit themselves for 8-10 hours a day. You know, and I mean, the why we're not talking about vocation in the church and just talking about mission, it's always boggled me. It's like we should be talking about vocation as mission, and then talking about these other projects we can get involved in. But vocation should be the key there. And this resource, is that available someplace that people can look up?
It is. If you go to Centered Life, if you Google Centered Life, it'll take you to their website. They have training where twice a year they bring teams of people in to be trained in the process, or you can bring their team out to your location and they'll do the training for you. We're going to try to cluster a group of 5 churches in the Rochester area to bring them out so that we can be trained in the process.
Cool. Was there maybe one other highlight then before we wrap this up for folks?
Yeah, worship is the other piece that I've really been drawn to, and you know, I have to say I've been to a lot of really bad worship. There's just a lot of bad worship going on, and it's discouraging. I usually leave with a headache and feeling deeply frustrated and wondering why people keep coming back. So I was excited to come to Scottsdale to experience worship at your place on Sunday, and was just deeply moved by the experience of the studio worship service and even the traditional worship service, that you figured out the importance of creating a space for people to experience the presence of God in their lives. And so many of the churches that I visited, worship is something like a cross between a town meeting and you know, a gathering where information is shared and a lecture and a time for prayer. But in terms of creating a space for people to experience the presence of God and to reflect on how God has been present in their lives throughout the week, it's really a rare thing. And I just sense there's a deep hunger for it. I think people keep coming hoping that their experience of worship will awaken them to the presence of God in daily life. And, you know, I have to say my own experience is most of the time I go away feeling hungry. So
you put some concrete examples behind that. Would you say that you saw a space open up for people experiencing God? In what ways did you see that happen?
Well, part of it is, in your 2 services, you have 2 very different music styles, but in both services, the music creates a Sabbath space. It creates a space for people to stop and to breathe deeply and to just be present. I think Sabbath is something we experience at such a deep need today, because we're just constantly racing from one thing to the next. I mean, we are a 24/7 society, and to come to church and to sit still and to just listen to music that stirs the soul is a powerful experience. It creates a readiness to hear, and then we're ready to hear the sacred text and to hear a message that invites us to think about how our own life experience is connected to the testimonies of those who have lived faithfully before us, and then to create space to contemplate on the significance as we leave church and return to all the ambiguity, all the difficult stuff that we have to wade through on Monday morning. Is I don't know how people make it through their week without that time to be recentered in God on Sunday morning.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, Tom, I really appreciate your spending some extra time with us this afternoon and sharing your insights. It sounds like your sabbatical really did kind of hit in many ways what you thought and also changed your points of view and other things. But bottom line, it sounds like you both learned to let go of some things and also learned what's really important to hang on to. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.